The first speaker tonight was a student activist in Ghana. He rose to the position of Minister of Youth and Sports in an administration headed by Jerry Rawlings. This person took the revolutionary position of self-determination in opposition to the invitation to the International Monetary Fund and World Bank to come in, and by so doing, allow Western interests to take control of the economy and the government of Ghana. And as a result of this struggle, our speaker, in the opposition, the revolutionary opposition, named the United Revolutionary Front of Ghana, is now residing in exile in London, waging a struggle against the authoritarian rule in that country and for democracy, for the right of working people and students, intellectuals to organize and struggle for the improvement and for the development of freedom in their country. He comes to us directly from London, and this is his first trip to the United States. Join with me in welcoming our brother and comrade, Zaya Yebo.
Thank you very much, Abdullah Kalimat. I must say that I am very honored to be with you this evening to share with you my thoughts on the world situation and the present state of Africa in general. To those of you who have been very familiar with Africa in recent years, I'm sure you would have been shocked to hear the horror stories that are coming from the continent, and you would have been wondering what has gone wrong all these years. Briefly, the history of Africa in the last decade or so has been characterized by immense political and economic crisis, which you are no doubt aware of. You would have seen the pictures of starving children in Ethiopia. You would have heard of all the wars in the Sudan, in Angola, Mozambique, and you would have seen the horrific atrocities committed by the apartheid regime of South Africa. As an African or a black person, you'll say to yourself, where did we go wrong, or what did we do to God to deserve all this? There are others who will also respond with serious moral indignation to the horror stories that are coming from Africa. But as an African talking to brothers and sisters, I can be frank with you and to say that what you have seen is only a tip of the iceberg. The real story is even worse than that. In saying that, I am simply trying to follow the spirit of honesty and courage which our leaders like Malcolm X, Kwame Nkrumah, and others taught us. That in dealing with issues of self-determination, in dealing with independence, in dealing with issues about struggle and revolution, honesty and courage are the most determining factors. Some of you will recall the times when Africa became independent in the 1960s, and we're all proud and very satisfied with ourselves that we're going to build a continent that any black person in any part of the world will be proud of. It appears that all the hopes generated in the 1960s have already given way to a certain spirit of despondency and of crisis. Gradually, we lost all the leaders who had a vision, leaders such as Kwame Nkrumah, leaders such as Lumumba and Nyerere, Amilcar Cabral, Modlenny, and others. We lost them all, one after the other. Outside Africa itself, we lost leaders such as Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. These events are not at all unconnected. They form a certain common trend of African history in the last three decades or so. Now, what we have seen in the last decade is that the path of nationhood, which we all thought independence would bring, has suddenly gone the other way. Instead of building independent countries, we have been able to establish neo-colonial countries and fronts for imperialism. Briefly put, we have gained our political independence, but economically, we are still controlled by Britain, France, the United States, and other such countries. And that explains, in very real detail, why Africa is in the present state. What is the cause of this economic crisis, or what is the cause of the crisis that we face in Africa today? I will take the explanation which others like Frantz Fanon took several years ago. Frantz Fanon said simply that the colonial legacy from which many African countries have come transformed economic relations in most of these countries, but these same relations failed to help Africa develop classes that were independent and had a solid material basis for their existence. Secondly, Frantz Fanon also said that the struggle for independence was equally spearheaded by nationalistic petty bourgeois and bourgeois classes whose only guiding principles were the populist sentiments or the anti-colonial face of the struggle that they were able to articulate. Beyond that, they had no other vision. Which meant that after independence, these classes struggled to legitimize their rule. But having failed to do that, ended up producing crises of proportions which I have just described. The result is the economic and the political crisis that we see Africa in today. Perhaps my own country, Ghana, serves as a very good example of this type of situation. Ghana became independent in 1957 under the very able leadership of Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, who is one of the foremost African leaders of our times. In 1966, this same leader was overthrown by the CIA. He was hounded into exile and he died in exile. Just like Malcolm X, his vision of Pan-African unity and of genuine political independence were never achieved because his life was cut short. In our case, from a very progressive government of Kwame Nkrumah, we have landed under a brutal military dictatorship led by one Flight Lieutenant Rawlings, who has ruled the country for the last 10 years. Rawlings has always been praised and idolized by the West. He's been seen as a very effective and capable leader who is trying to salvage Ghana from a very messy situation. But on the contrary, the opposite is what we've seen. Some time ago, one African leader said that if at any time you want to judge the effectiveness of an African leader, just find out whether he's being praised by the West or not. Anytime an African leader is praised by the West, then he must be doing something wrong to his own people. Anytime an African leader does something positive for the African people, he's called names. He's called a communist. He's called a KGB agent. He's called an anarchist and all kinds of names. And I think that the examples of Kwame Nkrumah and Malcolm X will testify to this. Let me say briefly that the last 10 years of this military dictatorship has brought about very serious social crisis in Ghana today. Under the banner of the IMF and the World Bank, they have made more than 500,000 workers redundant, thereby worsening the employment situation in the country. They've closed down most schools and health centers. And presently, all our economic facilities, the banks, the industrial areas are all under the control of IMF and World Bank officials. No major economic decision is made without consulting these officials. In effect, Ghana has just been recolonized by the World Bank and the IMF. What this simply means that is that Rawlings is not different from Mobutu or from Sergeant Doe or from all the other corrupt leaders that we've heard of in the past. Now, this brings us mainly to the question of this so-called new world order. What kind of world are we living in today? And what makes it possible for leaders like Rawlings of Ghana or Arap Moi of Kenya or Mobutu of Zaire to behave the way they do and get away with it? It is precisely because of what we now know as the New World Order, but some of us prefer to call the New World Disorder. We are living in what is now commonly called the post-communist world. Before Gorbachev, the basis for European unity was a kind of collective anti-communist hysteria. Arising out of this hysteria, they were able to build weapons of mass destruction. They were able to train agents to make sure that communism did not spread to other parts of the world. And generally, they held sway. Despite all that, they were not satisfied. The recent Gulf War and what has come out of it has enabled George Bush and other Western leaders to redefine the world and to try and reshape it to suit their own interests. And that is what they now call the New World Order. Historically, most wars have always been very helpful to the imperialist world. The First World War was very useful in helping to colonize Africa. The Second World War was very helpful in terms of the fact that it accelerated the incorporation of Africa into the world capitalist system. And I think that the Gulf War has also enabled them to reshape the world in the manner that they see fit. The essence of all this is that the world is being redivided. Our economic resources are being redivided among the major industrial powers, Germany, France, the United States, and indeed all the others. But one thing that is also most surprising is this, that in the midst of all these attempts to reshape the world, Europe is also going through a very serious economic and social crisis. 3 years ago, we were told that the only places where tribal wars were being fought was in Africa. Today, tribal wars are being fought all over Europe, even if we don't call them tribal wars. But what the Gulf War also taught us is that any nation that seeks to build an independent status, any nation that seeks to define its own agenda and to build its economy the way it sees fit, will be destroyed in the way that Iraq was destroyed, in the way that Libya was bombed, and in the way that Cuba is being threatened today. That means that all the years of struggle, all the efforts that all third world countries have put into building genuine independent countries are being threatened by this new world order. However, in the midst of all this, we still see hope. And I'll tell you the basis of this hope. In the last 5 years or so, the masses of Africa, that is, the students, the workers, the youth, the peasants, and so on, have been engaged in very serious battles on the streets with the ruling classes, that is, with the bourgeoisie of Africa. They have fought, they have demonstrated, and they have taken up weapons against all these pro-imperialist regimes on the continent. Now, all these struggles are beginning to bear fruit in the sense that all these dictators have come to the realization that you cannot continue to oppress people forever. And I think also that the kind of poverty that the continent has gone through in the midst of the plenty that we have has also had a very sobering effect on the way that people see Africa today. Now, the emergence of all these new democratic movements on the continent point to one thing, and that is, we are seeing what is now being called the second liberation of Africa. Second liberation in terms of the fact that it is now not a question of a struggle against colonial rule. Ours is a struggle against neocolonialism. In our specific case, any struggle against neocolonialism necessarily has to be anti-imperialist in terms of the fact that the ruling classes of Africa have very serious organic links with imperialist wealth. They have survived all these years because of the patronage which they get from the imperialist wealth, and therefore any struggle against this particular class necessarily has to be a struggle with or against multinationals and against the ruling classes of the West who are benefiting from our misery. The workers and peasants of Africa are challenging their rulers. They are calling for the creation of genuine participatory democracy. They are calling for those institutions which will make it possible for them to exercise power and to exercise it effectively. That means that, once again, as we did in the anti-colonial era, Africa is rediscovering its potential. Attempts are being made to create those internal conditions that will make it possible for Africa to make use of its huge material and human resources. The struggles of the African people will eventually lead to the transformation of Africa from a neo-colonial phase to a more revolutionary phase, a phase which will enable us to create create genuine independent countries where the economy of these countries will be controlled by us and not by others. In this light, we should see the new world order as an attempt to stop Africa from reaching this particular phase. But the present disorder in Europe, despite all the attempts at so-called unity in 1992, might work to our advantage in the sense that we'll be able to do things our own way. In the sense that these days you can struggle and not be called a Moscow agent because there is no Moscow. You can struggle and not be called a Chinese or an Albanian because none of those exist anymore. This time, we will struggle and perhaps be called Pan-Africans. And it is possible that Pan-Africanism will begin to be seen as a very vicious word in the sense that it will be seen as a potent force by imperialism. And anytime imperialism discerns that one particular force is potent, they will do everything to discredit it. They did the same to people like Kwame Nkrumah. They are trying to do the same thing to Malcolm X. And in the past, they've done the same thing to all African nationalists and people who have generally stood up for the independence of Africa. In brief, let me conclude by saying that the new world order that we are talking about is basically anti-African. It is basically against the independent development of the African people the world over, because Europe is for Europeans. Nevertheless, we have come to the realization, or the African people have come to the realization that we cannot continue to rely on charity. We cannot continue to beg forever to build our continent. And I think that is the basis for the present democratic struggles in Africa. And out of these struggles will emerge the Africa that every black person the world over will be proud of. Thank you.